Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI urges the faithful to convert and to be humble. The Anglican Bishop of Pretoria in South Africa, who negotiated an agreement between striking miners and the mine management, speaks of the situation of the miners and of the political implications of the unrest. Vatican Radio's film critic talks about an espionage thriller which sheds disturbing light on worldwide conspiracies and rogue authorities. And Father Jim Brand tells us to listen quietly when God speaks. Pope Benedict XVI has urged believers to convert, to change his or her way of thinking. Speaking on Sunday to pilgrims gathered for the weekly Angelus address, the Pope reflected on the Gospel of St. Mark. Pope Benedict said the second half of the Gospel deals with Jesus' final journey to Jerusalem, a journey that will culminate in his death and resurrection. After St. Peter's procession of faith in Jesus as the Messiah, the Pope recalls, Jesus began to speak openly about what would happen in the end. But he notes the disciples did not understand Jesus' words.
Appare evidente che tra Gesù e i discepoli c'era una profonda distanza interiore.
It is clear, the Pope says, that between Jesus and the disciples there is a deep interior distance. They are, so to speak, on two different wavelengths. And Pope Benedict says that this reminds us that God's logic is always other with respect to our own. God's ways are not our ways. For this reason, following the Lord requires of each person a profound conversion, a change in his or her way of thinking and living. And the Pope points to pride as a key difference between God and human beings. We who are little desire to appear great, to be first. While God, he says, who is truly great, is not afraid to be humble and makes himself last. And summing up this week's message for the English-speaking pilgrims present for the Angelus prayer, Pope Benedict reflected on the call to be the last of all and servants of all. May Christ's supreme act of love on Calvary, he said, always be our true measure of greatness. In South Africa, miners returned to work last week at the Lonmin Platinum Mine in Marikana after Lonmin resolved a five-week strike by agreeing to pay raises of up to 22%. 34 protesting miners were killed by police in Marikana on August the 16th, the worst state violence since the apartheid regime was brought down in 1994. A wave of unrest has left at least 46 people dead and many more injured, and protests have spread to a number of other mines. Anglican Archbishop Joe Seoka, president of the South African Council of Churches, was a key mediator in the standoff between the Lonmin management and representatives of the miners' trade unions. He was the one who informed cheering workers gathered at a stadium near Marikana mine of the deal, which was signed with Lonmin management last Tuesday evening. I spoke to him shortly afterwards, and he told me of the joy of the miners for having accepted the offer, giving them the possibility to go back to work.
My observation has been that there is a lot of joy, really, when they appeared on the television and in person for accepting the offer and for going back to work today. Nobody seemed to have been reluctant to do that. I don't believe that everybody is happy, but the majority of the people are very excited that at least they've got their jobs back after almost 6 weeks.
I've also been reading that depending on their category, the miners are receiving diversified pay increases. I think the rock drillers are receiving the largest percent. Has this solution proved satisfactory to all, do you think?
Well, look, they got 22% increase. That's a very unusual amount on salary increase. That would be, in a normal situation, salary adjustment. But that is what they demanded as an increase to their salaries, which creates a precedent that will make it very difficult for industry in future to deal with the demands of the workers outside the bargaining forum.
Now, the miners have always been very instrumental in bringing about change in South Africa. I'm thinking back to 1986, I think it was, when they made an indent in the apartheid system with their protests. Do you think this unrest will have political repercussions?
Well, it has political repercussions in various ways, one of which is that it changes the legislation of governing the labor relations of the country. And secondly, the bargaining forum or council will have to change its processes to accommodate trade union members. So there is a whole of redefining of how labor is to deal with these issues in future. But there is also a political issue that ministers are expected to deliver services, not to just talk. During the strike, the Minister of Labour had to be asked to come and talk to the strikers, and that was very helpful, and they explained to her what their needs were and asked for her intervention. And so that's a very political angle they took there. Because some people were saying, no, this has nothing to do with politics. It has all to do with the labor and the wages. And there is a space for that. But her involvement was very helpful in terms of explaining how the negotiation process happened through the organized labor. And that because they're outside the organized labor, it was a very special arrangement that was required to deal with this matter.
It's very complex from the outside. We are reading articles regarding the validity of the unions themselves in South Africa today. Do they still have the value that they did? And also the ANC itself, the governing party, which has always been seen historically as to be on the part of the workers, of the poor. And this standoff has seems to set it against the poor in a way. Do you agree with that kind of reading?
Well, to some extent, you see the landscape in politics in this country was influenced by the labor movement. They were part of the political movement. And the pressure they put in labor issues necessitated a speedy change to democracy. But there has been a general observation, and some leaders have agreed that the leadership has alienated itself from the workers. And so the gap has widened, as it is between the rich and the poor, for instance. And the workers are upset by that, but also for the fact that most of the political leaders were formed by the labor movement. The deputy president, for instance, was working with the trade union, and so is the general secretary of the ruling party. And so they feel like they've been let down by their very own people, and that needs to be addressed in future.
It also gives space to people such as Julius Malema, who seems to be firing up the crowds, exploiting their feelings of dissatisfaction. Are you worried about this kind of manifestation?
Yeah, it is a concern, really, because we're trying to separate labor issues from political ambitions. And the involvement of politicians does dilute the issues and confuse people. And so one would have preferred that politics stay out of labor issues so that the trade unions can do what they do better.
Archbishop, what conditions do the miners live in today?
Well, they're really appalling. the conditions are something that shouldn't be there, because mines do make a lot of money. They can easily improve the housing needs of the people there. But they literally live in squalors, most of them. If you go to Marikana, you would see that not far from the community, there is a dumping ground for all rubbish that people accumulate. And sometimes you see children scavenging on those dumping grounds. It's very unhealthy. But the whole issue of socioeconomic justice is a big challenge in this country. And it cannot be left unattended without serious consequences.
It is the challenge. It is the reason that this whole unrest actually took place, isn't it?
Well, basically, it's a combination of things. The main thing is exploitation of labor, low wages for heavy and dangerous work that people are doing. And secondly, it's the living conditions in which they find themselves that are unacceptable to them.
Archbishop, I don't know if you've heard this, but I've been reading on Reuters that two more people were killed on Wednesday by police at the Anglo-American platinum mine. Do you know anything about this?
Well, I heard about it. I've not had any confirmation, but I'm aware that a woman called Paulina, who is a local councillor, who was shot on Saturday by the police, and she died yesterday.
Surely after the terrible massacre that happened just, 3 weeks ago, the police have to be very, very careful what they do now.
Well, it seems they didn't learn their lessons, because they're still very aggressive and engaging with the people. This woman who died yesterday shouldn't have died, or shouldn't have been shot at in the first instance, because she was not even on the street. She was in an office of the local civic society. And therefore, how she got shot, nobody knows. And of course, nobody's going to admit that she was shot by the police. But everybody knows that she was caught on a crossfire.
This is really bad news. It has terrible echoes of the past. What do you hope will happen next, Archbishop?
Well, I'm hoping that many people will work for peace and reconciliation. I think something very drastic needs to happen there, in terms of bringing people together to talk about the issues that worry them, issues of concern, so that together they can build a better future.
Thank you very much. Is there anything else you would like to say?
I would like to say thank you for your interest and support, and for publicity that you have given to us over there. And we do hope this will come to pass, and that people will be happy as a community and as workers in that part of the world.
That was the Anglican Archbishop of Pretoria, Reverend Joe Seoka. And now, Peter Malone shares his thoughts and impressions about a just-released film that is bound to appeal to many. The film is The Bourne Legacy. It's all about the escape from rogue authorities of a specially trained operative and genetically modified secret agent, and about the worldwide conspiracies that go on behind the scenes.
What's your name?
Kat Kitson.
Will you give yourself to this program?
Yes, sir.
This is the kind of film, I must confess to you, I don't understand. It's an action-packed film, but I can't really see where it's going. Maybe you can help me.
Well, actually, I'll just quibble on one of the words you've just used. It's not quite action-packed. There is a lot of action in it, but it seems to me one of those films where you're supposed to use your brains to try to work out what is happening, who the characters are, and some moral judgments, especially about government agencies and espionage and morality.
There is nothing that you wouldn't do for this country. You have the strength to do what's necessary.
Did you notice the quote that I had at the beginning of the review? The quotation about moral irresponsibility.
Yes, morally indefensible, absolutely necessary.
I thought that was a great phrase when I heard the Edward Norton character saying it. And in a way, I think that's what these films are about. That a whole lot of stuff that goes on behind the scenes is, I suppose, morally indefensible, but it is interpreted for the good of whatever, the nation, the human race, that it's absolutely necessary. And audiences sitting watching a film like this say, I wonder. And as this film goes on, very much in the Robert Ludlum vein, though he didn't write the original novel, you're introduced into political conspiracies and espionage, people, you know, assuming an enormous amount of authority, which they really don't merit, and the repercussions then on victims, and especially the agents that they create, and the situations in which they put them.
It's Aaron Cross. We have never seen evaluations like this. He's Treadstone without the inconsistency.
That didn't sound too complicated, but it's that kind of film.
Let's just tell people who've seen the Bourne trilogy up to now that Matt Damon isn't in it.
His photo is in it, and there are mentions of him.
Jason Bourne was the tip of the iceberg.
So what they've done is they've invented a legacy for him so that the focus is on another agent.
Jason Bourne is in Manhattan.
Confirmed.
What?
That's all I have. Gotta go.
And he's considered in relationship to Jason Bourne, whether that was his real name, what was his identity, what were the missions that he was given, how was he influenced mind control.
People, listen up. This is a national security emergency.
The FBI is investigating links between Treadstone and this man, Jason Bourne.
All those kinds of things. So there's reference to the three films and some glimpses of some of the characters, Albert Finney and Joan Allen and Paddy Considine, a glimpse, so there's a connection. But I think anybody seeing this film without the others, they'll be focusing on the new agent, whose name is Aaron Cross, and he's played by Jeremy Renner.
So how many of us are there?
You ask too many questions.
One of the problems is Jeremy Renner's a fairly serious-minded actor, whereas Matt Damon could always give a kind of a smile and a smirk, and there'd be a touch of irony. There's not much irony, then, in this presentation of the new agent.
Peter, I see it's directed by Tony Gilroy. Is he the same director as the previous Bourne films?
No, he wrote them. The previous ones were directed by Doug Liman and Paul Greengrass, but they've moved on to other films, and so Gilroy is directing this film himself. It's very well directed. The first 20 minutes, I think it is, are just a focus on this new agent who's on an endurance test in Alaska. And it's very well done, the way that he survives, gets through the snow, is pursued by wolves, all kinds of things, till he comes to his destination. At which stage, the top agents and the bureaus started to track him down because they've been destroying all the agents in a special program. Now, he's one of them, and he eludes their pursuit all the time.
You're asking me to wipe the most valuable assets we've ever put in the field.
You start to consider the magnitude of what we're facing if this moves sideways on us. Meaning what? Meaning we will burn the program to the ground.
And so it becomes that kind of chase film as well. Especially as he goes to the laboratory where he was injected with chemicals, which they were testing out his capacity for endurance.
You've had alterations to two different chromosomes. It's the most exciting development in the history of the science.
Well, I'm not just a science project.
And they are then after the nurse, the research person, played by Rachel Weisz, who injected him.
Hey, look, it's me. Do you want to live? Because I want to live.
As they try to kill her, the both of them go on the run. And so it's that kind of chase. And that's when the action starts to come again towards the latter part of the film. they actually escape to Manila, and there is really an adrenaline-pumping chase throughout the streets and over the rooftops of Manila. Really very effective. So if some people thought it was a bit tough on their minds earlier, the adrenaline can race towards the end of the film and bring it to a conclusion.
So, of course, all these actions are in the minds of those who perpetrate them morally indefensible and absolutely necessary.
Yes, that they think they're running everything and they have the authority and they can create these programs and try mind control, and if something goes wrong, they can just eliminate their agents without any pangs of conscience. So that kind of thing.
Okay, let's go.
And now Father Jim Brand, in the third of his series of meditations on the scriptures, tells us how important it is to listen, to turn off the bright lights, and to pray in silence.
Last week, I was looking at the amazing thing that's happening when a messenger sent by God to Mary at the Annunciation in Luke chapter 1, verses 26 onwards. That the first thing the messenger does was to greet the lady, then compliment her, tell her she's full of God's love, and then said, "Do not fear." And I looked at the things that might stop us being afraid of God. Then we have another commandment that we don't often hear preached about. Listen. Listen. It's very hard to listen. Most people are broadcasting. Often when we're pretending to listen to somebody else's conversation or the insights, we're getting ready our own response. And we're thinking, what will be my intervention next? Because we're very good at broadcasting, not very good at receiving. And in prayer, it requires interior silence to hear God giving us pillow talk. He whispers in our ears, he doesn't shout. It means turning off our vulgar lights so that the stars come out. Because God's lights aren't always vulgar and bright. I know people who've gone to an island off England for a sort of meditative weekend and taken the radio with them. The radio's blaring all the time. People shouldn't be afraid of silence. That's where God is. And it's only when we're very quiet that we can hear his whispers. Listen. And then the message. The angel says to Mary, "Will you allow me, the Spirit, to love you?" Oh, that's the invitation that God gives to us all. Will you allow me to love you? Earlier I was mentioning that he stands at the door and knocks. I mean, there are some missioners who get their foot in the door and won't go. Frankly, invasive. The courtesy of the Lord is that he can only love us to the extent we give him permission. And that's the invitation he gives to all of us. Now, which part of my home am I inviting him into? Do I just invite him into the front porch? Or do I invite him into my formal rooms? Can he come into the drawing room that I know is tidy? Or will I invite him into the kitchen that's all over the shop with 3 weeks washing up still waiting to be done? Will I invite him into the intimate part of my house, the bedroom area? I know I've got a loft with all sorts of things in my life that I've put aside, not known how to deal with. Nasty memories, spooks. It's even frightening to go on one's own into the loft. There are probably diamonds in there as well as rubbish. How far have I allowed him into my home? Because I'm not holy enough to discern what is of value and what isn't. Only he can help me clear the loft of these spooks and these ghosts and these past memories, some happy, some sad. So he's asking permission for us to love him. And then Mary needed reassurance. We all need reassurance. And that's what we're all doing for each other, to reassure each other. That's what the church is about. It's a companionship. It's a fellowship for us to reassure each other. Because we're all in this together. No man is an island. Okay. And so the angel says to her, well, you go and see your cousin, St. Elizabeth. She's beyond childbearing age and she's 6 months pregnant. That'll make her hair stand on end. Mary thought, well, if it can happen to her, perhaps it can happen to me. Now, most of the people in the church today who are most upset are people who sit behind desks. They must, like Mary, go on a walkabout and see the wonders that are happening around them. I'm going to be 71 shortly. I've seen all the changes in the church. I fought them to start with, being a Pharisee of the Pharisees, and then I realised, who am I? It's not my church, it's the Holy Spirit's church. I must let go. And on the walkabouts I've had, I've seen miracles. Do you know somebody who's sad and has been kissed better? Oh, only the Holy Spirit does that, the evil one doesn't. Do you know someone who's left out and has been brought in? That's a wonder. Do you know someone who thought they were stupid and have been reassured? Do you know somebody who's sick and has been looked after by their family? Do you know people who live together for 50, 60 years and love each other still? We live in a world that broadcasts misery. No wonder it depresses people. There is good news out there if one will get off one's chair, like Mary, and go on a walkabout and see the wonders that God is doing. My country is still an island of saints. You wouldn't think so from the news. And be a universalist. To be a patriot is wonderful. You can only love the world in general if you love somewhere in particular, because the world in general doesn't exist. But if you're a nationalist, you've cut yourself off from Christ. As we shall see later, all the nations and all the tribes are going to be in heaven, so we might as well get used to a multicultural world now, because that's what heaven will be like. And England, thank goodness, is a multicultural society. We're getting ready for heaven. So let's go on a walkabout among all the cultures, all the languages, all the religions, all the colours, and see the wonders that are going on in the world. Then Mary went into a crisis. A crisis is where the scales are sort of balanced. You wonder what's going to happen. Over his last quartet, Beethoven wrote the words, muss es sein? Es muss sein. Must it be? It must be. And whenever the Lord asks us things, there is a crisis. The whole of the created world must have been on tiptoes. What is she going to say? What will she say? And eventually she said, I consent. Yes. Be it done to me. And that's what faith is. I consent to being loved. I consent to your will, O Lord. Amen.
Laudetur Jesus Christus.